Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 23rd of November. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Nearly December, Kev. Where's the year gone?
Is that just over 4 weeks to Christmas?
Oh.
I think so.
How are you feeling? Because last week you were, the week before, last couple of weeks, you've been feeling a bit under the weather.
I'll give you a cough just for the sake of it. Still coughing. It's like the cough doesn't go away completely, does it straight away? So, energy's still very low, to be honest, but getting there. Probably 50, 60%. Hopefully another week and I'll be feeling more alive. But yeah, there we have it.
Are we finally going to see an end to the Russia-Ukraine conflict? That's what's dominating the headlines this week. Obviously, we saw Vladimir Putin publicly backing the new US-drafted 28-point peace plan to end the Ukraine war, calling it a realistic basis for a final settlement. The plan is pushed hard by President Trump, including major concessions Ukraine had previously rejected, such as giving up territory in the Donbass and abandoning its NATO ambitions. Trump has now set next Thursday, Thanksgiving, as the deadline for Kiev to accept the deal. And Volodymyr Zelensky is, in a somber national address, admitted Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history, warning the country may be forced to choose between dignity or its key partner. He confirmed that he's been working closely with US officials, including VP J.D. Vance, to negotiate the terms. And meanwhile, Russian attacks continue across Ukraine with deadly strikes in Zaporizhia and Ternopil, underscoring the ongoing brutality, even as diplomatic pressure intensifies. So I guess it looks like we might finally see some sort of deal pushed along by Trump. What do you make of that? And what do you think, you know, from a not a selfish point of view, but do you think not only will it bring an end to massive amounts of loss of life, suffering, but also a bit more stability in the region?
Yeah. Is it really that much different than what was on the table 3 years ago? I don't think so. In fact, probably worse for Ukraine. And then at that time, Biden and our beautiful blonde-haired prime minister went out there and basically convinced them, no, you have to fight and you have to keep going. Yeah, it's sad. The whole situation is sad. Let's hope it comes to a solution, which means no more lives are lost, no more stupid amounts of money are spent on all the different things killing these people, and it is what it is. The reality is Russia was promised that NATO would not get closer to their borders, and this is what this whole war has been about, ultimately. So, yeah, let's just hope it happens. Yeah. And then we've had the good old Epstein files coming out here as well.
Yeah.
I haven't really.
It's been a couple of weeks, isn't it? Before we've had the emails, but the actual proper files that are going to be released by the Department of Justice will be sort of dripped out over the next 30 days, apparently. But yeah, I think there's going to be a lot more to raise its ugly head from those. That's for sure. You know, and a lot of people going to be implicated in them once it finally gets out. But yeah,
yeah. Then we obviously let's rush headlong into something much more fun, and that is grannies and Lamborghinis. You caught up with somebody there during the week who's putting Lambos and grannies together. So do you want to introduce
something a little bit more lighthearted and positive in this world? So yeah,
So let's move on to our first guest this week. Today, a welcome departure from the usual format to focus on a remarkable charitable initiative whose single aim is to combat loneliness. Joyriders brings together supercar owners and older people, creating memorable experiences and meaningful social engagement. We're very pleased to be joined by its founder, Mark Cody. Mark, thanks for joining us. Welcome.
No, thanks, Phil. Appreciate you guys having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. I mean, let's go back to the start, Mark, on this one. What was the moment that made you want to take action against loneliness? And how did that evolve into this incredible idea of using supercars as a way to make a difference?
Yeah, no, it's incredibly important to me. I mean, this the inception point for me was sadly back in 2021. My elderly grandmother decided to take her own life. Unfortunately, this was, you know, a really harrowing time for us, Phil, as a family. Wanted to understand whether this was an isolated incident or something that was, you know, further spread afield. So I spent, you know, a lot of time trying to research and understand whether there was other people who were affected by this, you know, where that elderly loneliness and feeling isolated was a, like I say, a widespread impact. And I got a resounding yes to that, which blew me away. And one of the things where, you know, as all good things sometimes have to start or always have to start is just from an idea. So for me, the idea was, look, I'd always promised my nan, bless her, that one day when I, you know, when I'm successful enough, I'll take her out in a Lamborghini and we'll have a great day out. Now, sadly, that day, you know, never came. But I made a promise to myself, you know, that, look, it might not be my nan where we can take out, unfortunately, but I'm going to go take other people's grandparents out and elderly parents and get them out of the house and give them something to get excited for, give them that date in the calendar where they can go, yes, I'm going to get dressed today. I'm going to get out. I'm going to get out of my comfort zone, do something fun that might inspire others. And can we turn this into a movement? Can we turn this into a, you know, an inspirational way to raise awareness in a fun and exciting medium, such as getting behind the wheel of a supercar and taking them out for the day? And it's just spiraled from there, Phil. It's been, you know, it's been the most amazing journey. And, you know, ultimately for me, this will be my life's work.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. And you can tell your passion for it. I mean, obviously, I'm really sorry to hear about your grandma. I mean, it's something that we expect in younger people. We hear about, you know, highest age specific range, I think, was for males around 45 to 49 years. They're the sort of like demographic that you hear of who are really impacted by suicide. But when you look at the statistics and also on loneliness in the older adults in the UK, it's something like 7% or 1 in 14 of people aged 65 plus, you know, equivalent to about 940,000 older people are often lonely. And there's more than 2 million people aged over 75 living alone in England. I mean, that some of these numbers are actually crazy. And that, you know, not only that, but loneliness is linked to serious health issues, you know, risk, increased risk of coronary heart disease, stroke, dementia, depression, and anxiety. So I guess, as you said, like when you first came up with this idea, and obviously, you know, when you first started delivering, and you know, what a selfless act, the fact that you, I think you're pretty sure you hired some of these vehicles yourself from your own money, took them to the care homes. What was the initial sort of reaction when the elderly saw the vehicles and heard them and then got in them? Can you describe some of the feelings and that, and what that the buzz you got from that as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's I can picture every single one of them now. It's such a heartwarming, overwhelming experience for me, you know, for when we initially hired these cars, and I just assumed that would be a cost for existence for forever, you know. But I felt like it brought me closer to my nan, and it, you know, and I wanted to inspire other people, you know, on my daughters to realize that you can come up with a bit of a daft idea and go do something incredible for good for the rest of humanity, and you know, that can start from anywhere. So that's always been the ambition. But yeah, when we, you know, when we took these cars, and even pulling up outside somebody's house and they open the curtains and they see this bright orange Lamborghini, and they, you know, they walk out to the front of the house, and their neighbors are coming out and saying, "You can't be getting in that Batmobile, you know, what are you doing, Doris?" or whatever it might be. It's amazing. And you, like I say, they jump in, and well, I say jump in, that's probably a bit too strong, but
fall in, and then the gravity helps you in, but it doesn't help you out, does it?
Yeah, exactly that. And you know, there's no way of kind of putting it into words, but the joy, you know, the moment you spend with them, you're in an isolated environment, you have nowhere to go, you have to get out of the house to get into a car, so you have to be physically there, obviously, and you're with a stranger ultimately. So you end up having these conversations that they may not have with a family member or a friend, because they're scared of hurting them, are scared of, you know, getting them concerned about how they truly feel. So it, you know, you can have these really interesting open conversations. But when they leave and they step out, and you know you give them a bit of fun with putting your foot down a little bit, like, you know, in a controlled way, they step out of the car 20 years younger, Phil. It's, you know, I've never seen anything like it. I really haven't.
Absolutely, yeah. And obviously, I reached out to you after seeing you on BBC Breakfast News one morning. You know, I'm sat there, you know, eating my breakfast as I do, and all of a sudden, you know, supercars mentioned, and obviously that piqued my interest as a sort of, you know, basically a supercar club owner myself. You know, members owning some incredible cars. I knew I just had to get involved and reach out to you. And then since then, I've managed to source a Lamborghini for you to use for the care home residents. And then obviously that led to an appearance on This Morning with Betty from Sheffield joining you on the program. Just how surreal was that moment when you actually drove into the set and actually, you know, with Betty at the side, and, you know, met obviously Dermot and Alison, that, you know, just talk us through that experience.
Yeah, never did I in my wildest dreams think that that would ever be a reality. You know, I've never seen anything happen like that before, whether, you know, you've drove a Lamborghini with an 82-year-old lady from Sheffield onto a live set of TV. But what an experience. You know, I can't thank you enough for being able to support with the car, you know, film. Like I say, the rest of the club at VC have been amazing. And just the willingness for people to get involved, that's really blown me away. The support, you know, we've seen reach out. I've been, you know, on publications from New Mexico to the US to China to, you know, Colombian national radio stations, and it's blown me away. But I think where, you know, where it's resonating with people is they want a good news story. They want to see somebody trying to do good against all odds. You know, I don't have a supercar, you know, but it's not stopped me from trying to figure out a way where we can make these things happen. And, you know, and seeing people from the car community and wider, you know, further afield get behind this is, it's changed my, you know, view on everything, really.
Absolutely. And obviously, as you just said, the traction you seem to be getting right now in the mainstream media, you know, obviously BBC Breakfast News this morning, you've had other people in ITV Calendar, I believe you've done some pieces, you're even on the ITV Evening News as well. So you've been on pretty much all the major kind of mainstream news outlets. You've reached as far afield as Indonesia, as like Mexico, Ecuador, places like that, which is unbelievable. And even Australia with like Supercar Blondie, and I think some of the American, Northern American outlets have also reached that. So where do you see this going? You know, what are the next steps, I guess, and the next question, and where do you see Joyriders, aka Lamborghini, in 26, 27?
Yeah, I mean, we set out on this mission ultimately, Phil, to be able to positively impact as many people as humanly exists, right? You know, how can we have that impact on people? And that's really a scale operation. So for us, we're ramping up, you know, getting the core team. For me, I'm trying to create, you know, what I call like the baddest team. I want people to get excited behind this, who you know, want to go against the norm of what getting old looks like. Come do that in a fun way. Let's go break some Guinness World Records together. We've got a big UK tour planned next year. I think we're going to end up calling this, you know, Total Granarchy. We've got some really interesting things lined up. And for me, it's doing things outside the box. It's going against the grain. Can we scale that operation globally would be the ultimate aim, because it turns out that elderly loneliness is not just something that happens in Sheffield nor in the UK, but further afield. And how do we get to people?
Very good. So explain how it all works, Mark. I mean, obviously you've got the website at the moment, Lamborghini.com. Let me use the sort of the buzz phrase, fuel by fun focuses on impact, which is brilliant. And on the website at the moment, that you can either submit a grand, which is an incredible button to have, what a call to action that is, and then or join the car club. So presumably you could put forward, you know, a granddad, someone who's lonely, or a driver with a vehicle can say, I want to join your car club. I want to basically give some of my time at the weekend or whenever it is to you with my vehicle. Is there anything else you need? I mean, do you need finders, backers, volunteers to help you? Just tell us what you want and we'll try and put the feelers out to listeners.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, it's a really interesting one. I've, you know, we spent a lot of time over the last few weeks understanding how to turn this from, you know, a one-man operation on a monthly basis, taking a handful of people into something, like I say, potentially global. So yeah, we need all the help we can get, Phil. And for us right now, that is, you know, we need car owners who are willing to come and donate some of their time and join the club. But you know, in return, they're not joining a, you know, potentially come in the car park and have a conversation. It's a wholesome ride. You are changing somebody's life with what we do here, and ultimately potentially saving them. So that's, you know, that's we'll you know, we'll hand out the Superman capes as you kind of come and join and get involved. But it's really, can you get behind this mission and what we're about? And the main part for off the back of that is we need to be able to survive, and we need to be able to do that financially in order to continue on this mission. So we need, certainly from that point of view, some backers who just get behind this mission with us, who can see the clear route to, you know, the end goal of being able to continue to help other people at scale, and doing this in a fun and exciting way. So like I say, for everybody else, please keep contacting us, submitting, you know, your neighbor, an elderly, you know, an elderly person who gets forgotten about, whether it's your sadly your dad's passed away and your mum's not been out of the house for a while, whatever it is, get in touch. We'll make it our mission to always get a response back to every single person. And if we can try and plan an event that where we get to you as well, we'll, you know, we'll pledge to that as well.
Yeah. I really like that as well, that the fact that you could almost bring together, there's three parts of the diagram. You've got the joyriders, you've got the drivers, and you've got the backers. And when you put that together on one website whereby you have the three buttons, so, you know, you can join the car club, you can request or submit a grant, but they can also, people can also maybe say, right, Doris in Sheffield wants, I can see that she wants a ride in whatever it is. And we've got the driver, Derek, who's got a McLaren. So I'm going to pay for Doris to go out. And then ultimately that happens, that you arrange for all that to happen. And then the backer, you know, Derek or whoever who paid for that ride will get to see the video of an away from, you know, from Doris or whatever when she experiences it. So you can almost see, like, it's a really rewarding thing for everybody who's involved.
Massively. And I think you're right, Phil. I really do. I think the opportunity to change somebody's life with something simple like that is absolutely there. And can we remove enough friction so people can get behind these things and make it as simple as possible? So we were talking about, there's obviously platforms out there such as Patreon and Kickstarter where those opportunities happen all the time. And you see, you know, these incredible stories from people where the whole world gets behind these, you know, look at, like I say, there's a lot of cases out there previously where that's been the case. And I just think for the people who are forgotten about and left at home and where they've got nothing to look forward to, they're the people we want to get to. They're the people we want to change their lives. And that can happen in such a simple way. It doesn't have to be, like I say, you know, you don't have to have a supercar to get involved. What you can do is you can like our content, share our content, get involved, you know, donate some time or energy. Or like I say, if you want to get behind backing us as well, then even, you know, absolutely. You know, in order for this to be a globalized movement, we need every person we can to get behind this.
Absolutely. All right, Mark. Well, I mean, it's been great to have you on, and we wish you all the best in the future. I'm sure you're gonna have a resounding success with it. It's it touches the heart of everybody, as you say, everybody who's involved. And yeah, we say Mark Cody, founder of Joyriders. Thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate all of your support.
So let's move on to our next guest. We're joined by Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources. Welcome back, Colin. How's life?
Not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. I'm getting to the end of the summer all over the place now. Everybody's saying how cold it is and the weather's changed. And so that's good. Obviously, we're not here to talk about the weather. We're here to talk about how things are in general around the world. And I see that demand for copper continuing. I'm not even certain which way gold's going to go. It's knocked me off my perch anyway to understand what's driving it so fast and so hard. And then, of course, silver we got running alongside. So we're in a very interesting world, which doesn't change very much from podcast to podcast. And when I'm given the opportunity to come onto these podcasts, I'm always delighted to say, gee whiz, you know, from last time we sat together, this has strengthened, that strengthened. Obviously, it can't go on forever, but it's a very, very positive environment in which we're working compared to what we were working 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. So we were just talking in their preamble about the price of gold, and, you know, almost every week it seems to bust through all-time highs. We see it around the sort of 4,000 mark, and silver's around the $50 to $51. How do you see things moving in the future? You know, what do you think, there's still going to be a pent-up demand for these precious metals and critical minerals?
I basically steer clear of silver and gold. I know there are additions to most of our, quite a few of our situations. My mind and everything I think and do is driven by copper. And the fundamentals for copper won't change, and I don't think can change in the short term. As I think I've said before in one of your podcasts, in 2017, I was sure that a junior who built up a portfolio of copper would probably live to see the day where that became very, very valuable. And I've been sort of, my career has shown that the commodity a junior is working, if that commodity is on fire, then it generally, the junior becomes a call option to it. So I would have expected by now all the small companies who are on the standard listing who are copper and close to production to have total re-ratings. Of course, that hasn't happened. And why it hasn't happened, I don't know. But the one thing I'm absolutely convinced about is that in 2017, when I embarked upon this mission, the demand certainly has come to being with the other sources of demand, particularly Indian growth And my estimation was not based on electric cars. They've stalled. They're basically up against it, headwind, and there's a lot of things to be sorted out in the electric vehicle world. But infrastructure, new economies, new disposable income, emerging countries, all of those things are adding to the copper, and AI are adding to the copper demand, whilst the supply side, I just don't see anything happening. I really don't see anything happening. So either the majors, you don't create new copper by merger and acquisition. So the majors, sooner or later, are going to have to go out shopping. But will that change the dynamics for 26, 27, 28, up to 30? Of course it won't. To buy a smallish company, what's got expiration potential, you've got to basically work the existing small mine, and you've got to then basically get into exploration and go through the absolute process, exploration through to evaluation, through to permitting, through to production. And there's gone 10 years. So the supply side is wrecked. I firmly believe that there's a sort of tsunami coming in terms of the copper price. It just hasn't been addressed. The majors, I don't know, just dividend bound. They're all trying to get as much copper out of the same facilities. But mining is a depleting subject. You know, every day you take away some of your asset. And unless you replace it, and have got it replaced, a CEO of a major mining company, you're in trouble. So I've again said on this program, I think, you know, I can't see the day far away. In fact, I see it now, I think, that the analysts of the companies like Goldman Sachs, you know, the top analysts said, yeah, these earnings all look very impressive. These dividends and earnings per share all look impressive. But are they sustainable? Where's the replacement mines? Where's the capital provisions? And I think the industry is going to have to face up to that soon. And the turnover of CEOs in major mining companies is horrendous. It's almost like presidents and prime ministers. And they're just dividend driven. And they just has not been enough. Mankind has not over the years, over the last 20 years, put enough money back in the ground against what they've taken out. And so what we're doing is we're creating, as I say, that perfect storm, that tsunami of a copper price which could go out of control. I said at a presentation in London, nicely attended 2 years ago, and the opening slide said we fought wars on oil, and we fought wars, and we probably end up fighting wars on copper. I was a bit tongue-in-cheek at that stage, but you know, when I look at the situation now, and when I look at the antics of the various players in the copper market, I'm not so sure. When I say various players, you should actually extend that to countries as well, because with the advent of Donald Trump and tariffs and all of those things and pumping money into various commodities, embargoes on certain commodities, it's a very dynamic place in which small companies like ours are operating.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see a world that we're moving into where copper isn't going to be worth more than it currently is. Especially with in the last 2 or 3 years, I don't think anybody envisaged any people looking at the technology side of things that they thought AI and the ability for basically multitudes to use AI believed that it was going to happen this quickly. And not only that I don't think anybody really clicked how much energy is going to be required to actually power those AI things, both data centers and just pure energy. Now, all of that energy has to be transmitted. And what is it transmitted with?
I must say that's one I didn't, the AI evolution, that's one I didn't back on. And that's completely, you know, any projections on demand that you've got are completely blown out of the water with that one. So, you know, philosophically speaking, I see the fuel cell to be the ultimate, where everybody in the garage has got a fuel cell. And, you know, there you are, your exhaust is oxygen, and, you know, you're using hydrogen. The catalyst is platinum, so just one problem to another problem. But, you know, that's talking 30 to 50 years. We're talking the next 10 years, and I just do not see, there's two projections, which are completely wrecked. Is when the do-gooders and all the disciples that were going to sort out the world said that we won't need any fossil fuels by 2027, 2028. Absolute nonsense, and we've seen that, and we know that. We burnt more fossil fuel last year than we did, and you know, the claims of the scientists that, oh well, the renewables provided more last year than the year before, they barely kept up, if they kept up at all, with the demand. So the fossil fuel argument's gone through the window, and projections of demand have gone up. And the other than China, nobody's doing much about building new mines. And China's going for the easy, low-hanging fruits as well. So we'll be into a very difficult world. And the replacement has to be, I think, in you know, the mid and long term, has to be nuclear. I mean, those mini nuclear power stations, they must have to play their role in time. Certainly, I can't see wind farms and photovoltaic taking the big role that some people anticipate. So the next big one, I think, is probably uranium, nuclear energy. But all of this is years away. You have to build these facilities. So the copper boom, let's call it a boom, the increase in copper demand compared to the supply, there's such an imbalance that, it's not in actual fact a sort of economic distortion. It's almost frightening, absolutely frightening to me. I'm glad to be part of it at the right end of it, but I do hope mankind doesn't take a rattle and a knock because of it.
Yeah, but the thing is, Colin, even if you look at, you know, supply and demand dynamics, even before 2025, they were looking poor. But three of the world's biggest copper mines, Grasberg, El Teniente, and Kahula, they've all been hit this year. So the shortage in 2026 is going to be quite brutal, you know, potentially more than what, you know, these majors aren't particularly, I think they're not being particularly honest about how bad the damage really is at those facilities.
That's right. I'd like to know really what the situation is at Grasberg. I think a lot of people would as well. We know down in Chile, there's probably going to be a right-wing leader that might affect the might bring a more positive attitude to copper, but it's not going to build new copper mines overnight. And a lot of the existing copper mines are suffering from 20 years under capital expenditure and are going towards an end life or actually very, very expensive production. So again, a new president in Chile, which is one of the biggest suppliers of copper to the world, a right-wing, more positive approach to copper production. There's no overnight fix there either.
Yeah, it's not easy, is it? I mean, the problem I've always found with Chile and South America, it tends to go on this kind of seesaw, right, where you have a left-wing president who makes the mining tax and co too onerous. So the production drops and they get less revenue. So you get a right-wing president come in and say, we'll make it easier for you. And so more of a tax comes in, but then they look at it and they go, we want a bit more tax. And then a left-winger comes back in again. And it just yips and yams, isn't it?
Yeah, and First Quantum, I haven't got their Panama bike yet, you know. And
yeah.
They spend nearly 11 million billion than they did $10 billion on this project. And their care and maintenance costs are woeful. So, you know, there's another typical example of Latin American knee-jerk politics.
Well, even if you look at Freeport, as in Freeport Maroon, which is one of the world's largest copper producers, I'm not sure if you caught this, but I think it was last month, 2 months ago, they announced that they were planning to break away from the benchmark pricing system, the one that undermarks global sales of mined copper ore. Do they just not believe in the traditional market pricing? Do they think they can just get better prices than what the global market suggests?
I think, you know, that when we have the discussion we're having now, you know, you've got to go back, and they used to have these fixed price kind of monopoly situations for various commodities. Then along came the traders, and some of them are usually profitable. I think traders have got to look inwards as well, because what I'm seeing now, and not so much in copper, but in some of the other metals, is that the end user is going direct to the miner, and they're actually investing in junior miners. Mm. And the reason for that is we're reaching a stage, I think, that the availability of the raw material is more important than its price. And well, I think some end users are actually getting scared. And so the trader, you've got to sit back and say, well, what does the trader do? What does he do, really? He basically sits in the middle and moves whatever commodity is from the mine to the end user and makes a packet doing it. And does the end user really need him? It needs to have security of supply. If security of supply becomes very competitive, then he'd be better off not making a trader rich, but in actual fact to get into bed with the supplier so that his 5-year supplies are guaranteed. And I'm seeing this slowly, but I think with copper, it might in actual fact come more quickly.
No, I think it will too. I mean, the interesting thing, if you look at the top end of the US tech stocks, right, the multi-trillion dollar Magnificent Seven, so your NVIDIA's, your Google's, your Amazon's, your out, you know, these stocks all in the end rely on metals. And I wonder whether, you know, they are looking at mining now, they're looking at metals as an insurance policy in the future. If they invest a few billion now, which is pennies to them, do they secure their own futures because they'll need that raw supply? I don't know. I kind of see it happening. And nation states as well, obviously, if you look at the US, if you look at the European Union, China, Australia, everywhere, it's exactly the same. They're all throwing money at metal supply.
That's right. I mean, the Japanese have been doing that for a number of years in copper, I suppose, in a different way. They did it with platinum too, with their offset programs. So they invested in companies that mine their raw materials, and the profitability they got, the profits they got there from the dividends they got, was an offset against their cost of purchasing the raw material. So I see more and more of these offset programs coming in.
Yeah,
which that was the Japanese 20 years ago.
How much gold did Tether buy recently, Charles, or over the last period of time?
Well, as of last quarter, I think it was, what, 8.7 billion off top of that? Yeah. And obviously that's a huge amount of gold. But I think it's, you know, my bigger thing, other than sort of like the tech stocks coming in and, you know, taking advantage of the metals, is just generically, it's just the global equity ratio, right? Like mining was 11% of global equities in the 1960s. Obviously, you've had a tech revolution, you know, the internet and the dot-com bubble, and then the artificial intelligence. But mining was 11%. Now it's only 1% of you know, the global pie. That's going to have to shift upwards. And then in particular, just specific metals that are being, you know, targeted in this US-China trade war. Tungsten, obviously, is getting a lot of limelight at the moment, as is rare earths. But antimony has been a massive outperformer. And obviously, Colin, you've got exposure to some fairly decent antimony deposits as well, don't you?
Yeah, more than decent. And they're, you know, that in a lot of situations, in fact, most situations, antimony is the byproduct, you know, with gold and silver mines in Coeur d'Alene up in Spokane in America. A bombed out, probably a bombed out is the wrong expression, but a gold mine which had pretty well depleted. It got a big swag of money in America the other day, and because of its antimony byproducts. So we've got antimony, but not as a byproduct to anything else. And quite frankly, when I went, you know, it's in Morocco, when I went on my mission to assess it, I got a very, very pleasant surprise in terms of thickness, in terms of pure, you know, the way you could detect it, continuity, and the fact that it generally occurred in a mountain and cropped out. So no work's been done in the plains by the artisanal miners, you know, below the mountains there, because that's difficult to get chased out by water plus conditions very quickly. So the style of mining, the limited mining that there's been, is that you have an exposure in a mountainside and they follow it as far as they dare go before the side walls drop in on them. So I go inside these tunnels and lo and behold, you know, it's a very expensive way of mining, Charles, when you actually use the tunnel to mine, and only a part of the tunnel contains the reef, if so to speak.
Yeah.
But that's how the artisans do it. And then I walked in one tunnel, and of course you'll see that Amgas, we've purchased all of the rights to that. And that Amgas tunnel inside there, you actually see stoping where they went off the sidewall, chased the reef, and daylighted the way it came out in the side of the mountain. So this was real open stoping. And semi-sophisticated, proper mining, as I would call it, proper mining. And the opportunities for that at Amgas are great. And there's a quarry, we talk about open pit, but it's not an open pit. It's something, you know, you're mining the side of a mountain. That quarry, by definition, as we extend it, we will pick up more and more exposures that we'll be able to chase into the center of the mountain. And I've got a secret hope that the closeness, it's not very secret now, that the closeness of the veins are such that we might be able to take it en masse without chasing it with tunnels and underground mining. We may be able to take it out en masse. So we've taken the decision, and we raised money last week for it, as you should probably know, to actually go mining sooner than later. We were, you know, I was sort of tempted to go the intermediate route because the antimony performing so well. to do what everybody else is doing there in Morocco, what's involved in antimony, and that was make the intermediate project at 10 to 15% antimony. But my experience tells me that in these specialty metals, that intermediate product, when you get some equilibrium in supply and demand, the price doesn't go off. Nobody wants it. So we're going the Olog fast, and we're building a flotation plant. We've procured the flotation plant. We've got to get the final negotiations done. Hopefully, I'll be now. We've got to get the financial, you know, the final financial arrangements done. They're not massive plants. So it's not as though we've got a 14-month, 20-month build. They come in a few containers, very small plants. And we're open in the not-too-distant future to produce a very high-quality antimony product. And by the way, we've done test work, and there's a silver contribution as well to our antimony. So the AmGas project is completely self-contained. It's got it's a quarry, it's mines which want rehabilitating, and we've got the benefit of about between 50 and 80,000 tons of plus 3%, which was mined probably water many, many years ago anyway, and is available for processing. So we've got a 50,000 ton start while we rehabilitate the mines and rehabilitate the quarry. So that's AmGas, and then some distance away we've got another 25 blocks where there's artisanal working around us, where we're going to do exploration in the plain where nobody ever did any proper mining at all. But so when I say it's artisanal, it's very, very rudimentary, working away at exposures which are very, very exposed and not taking it to any depth. So we know it's there. Yeah. We know it's continued from the mountains. And we know we can build up a meaningful resource, and we know what's more important whilst this polarization's going on, you know, because the Chinese have got most of the antimony. We can make our associations in the West within the offtake. Because in a specialty metal, to me, it's important that we complete the loop. So we're talking to a number of groups about marketing. And you'll know that I think Cairn has put money in Canada. He's put money into antimony projects, into the junior sector. Trump has obviously put money, as we all know, into antimony, and they realise that, like rare earths, they really need their own antimony supplies, and it's quite ironic, really, when you talk rare earths and when you talk antimony, it's all in China and Russia.
Well, so
our position in Morocco is very good, thank you very much.
I've got a question for both of you, okay, just before you step in, Charles, and ask some more detailed questions. What is antimony? What is it? What's it used for? And like physically, what is it? What does it look like? The metal.
Okay, it's silver. It's toxic. I know this. It's metalloid, and I know the atomic number is 51 because these things are drilled into me from my chemistry A level many years ago. The most important thing is it hardens alloys and batteries. But in terms of like its strategic use in you know the world, it's ammunition. It's armor-piercing rounds. It's military uses. China's put export controls on antimony, which is why it's pushing up the prices. And I believe that the US Department of War have decided they want to have a big stockpile. I think it's $245 million of the stuff. And they're going to struggle to fill it up because they're simply, you know, it's difficult to get it out from not China. So incredibly important, and its price has been on an absolute tear as a result. Colin, anything to add?
No, that's very good summary. I think heat resistance properties is its biggest plus, and its military use and the lack of Western supplies is what's driving the price up, and protectionism by the Chinese and what available supplies they've got.
So when you say the price,
they're all over the place buying antimony. Like they're all over the place buying everything.
But in terms of you say the price has been on a tear. How much does this stuff go for per ton?
There's so many. Charles, there's so many different classifications of antimony, be it ingot, be it salts. It's very, very difficult to say, but the reality is up by multiples of 10, 15. Is that fair, Charles?
Well, I think it depends on your perspective. In the first half of this year, it went up around 70%. But if you look at the producers, as in the major antimony producers, ex-China, a lot of them have seen their profits double in the past year. That gives you an indication, much like tungsten or titanium, there's so many different types of products on the market, and it's such a thin market that it's very difficult to give you know exact pricing. But it is, you know, incredibly more profitable than it was a year ago. And I think the key point is that even if China loosens its export controls, Western, powers will still want that supply chain security, so they're not going to let their foot up anyway. So the prices are unlikely to come down, even if those controls are relaxed.
So we look at tungsten. Tungsten is, I think, now $60,000-$70,000 a ton, or maybe even more in terms of that. What is it comparable? Copper's 11,000 per ton. What is antimony roughly?
Around 51,000 if you look at the fast markets price. But again, it's different sources will command different prices, and ex-China prices will have a price premium. So probably a bit higher.
Yeah, we will be mining a pure antimony concentrate. We're going to float off the gang and produce a plus 50% antimony product. We'll keep it as simple as that. And then you'll sell it to the various end users, and they will turn it into salts, into ingots, into whatever.
And then I've got one more question for you, Colin. What's more exciting to you, the antimony in Morocco or Silver King? And yourself?
I basically... I've taught myself, and it was quite difficult to do, that not to fall in love with any single project. And, if I go back 10 years or so, technical challenge was always very exciting. And you've got to be very, very careful when you're running the business for the shareholder not to get excited with technical challenges. So I'm excited about the antimony because we've got a market. We're probably the only AIM company. I think the UK company was seriously into antimony, was talking about starting production soon, and that's completely missed everybody. So from a pure marketing and entry position and new project position, that gets me up in the morning, and I'm very happy about that. But I'm also very, very impressed with what we've got at Silver King, and that's part of a mission which has been going on since 2017. And Silver King gives us an exploration project, as you know, and is an exploration project, as you know. I mean, it's got five or six targets still, and we're busy exploring, and we've got some results. So we now have two sets of phase one, phase two results. And we're partners are commencing a small mine, and we've decided to earn into the small mine, which is, again, part of the raising that we did last week. And we feel that anywhere where you've got the ability to mine... at the same time, explore, you're demonstrating to the trade that you've got both ends of the coin. You're exploring for more of the same, but you've found an opportunity to commence production. And that's got a third benefit, of course, because if one gets significant surplus of income over expenditure, you're not always going out to the market to raise money, because we juniors do get criticized for raising money. But when you're not revenue producing, Charles, your shares are your currency. And so what I've learned over certainly the last 5 years, when the market completely dried up, one should be aiming towards production. And that production, not by coincidence, I'm going to claim strategy, is that we've always, our small production capability is generally attached to large scale exploration potential. I think the market has got indigestion. They're tired of hearing about deposits which have got the potential to be 5 million ounces of gold, to be 1.5 million tons of copper. They want to see a bit of production. They want to see a bit of credibility. They want to see their money being turned into profit. And they want also that profit to be diversified into exploration on some occasions, not straight out of their pocket, straight into exploration. Because we all understand the exploration risk. It's a risky business. It's a risky business, and if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And of course, they're not. So, in Silver King, and what has Zambia and Morocco got in common? We're starting small mines. In one place, Morocco, it's antimony. In the other place, Zambia. In Zambia, it's copper. In both places, alongside, nearby, we've got large exploration projects. So I think we've got a kind of a company style which says small-scale production coupled with large-scale exploration. And I don't think that can be a bad position to be in. And because we started this venture early, Charles, we started early, I think we're in the best position on AIM. It's not as though we started yesterday, woke up and thought that was a good idea, because life doesn't work that way. Try and build up this portfolio now. You wouldn't stand a hope in hell of having a portfolio like ours. You look at the extract portfolio, just how nice it is in terms of what it's got and the positions it's got. If you wanted to start now from zero, you wouldn't be able to do it. You just wouldn't be able to do it. Takes time, takes perseverance. So common model, we raised money last week. We raised money purely to accelerate the beginning production of the antimony mine in Morocco, our first one, and the Silver King small mine, copper mine, while we continue to explore. So which am I most excited about? Both.
Right.
Not a very good answer, I know, but that's the answer.
No, that's fine.
As a forward-looking statement, which is difficult, if I interview you this time, let's say December 2026, do you expect copper and silver to be coming out of Silver King, and do you expect antimony to be coming out of Morocco?
This time next year, the same time next year. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm actually talking about a flotation plant, which will be taken out of the box in February, to Walvis Bay down. We'll be taking out the containers in February, March next year. So that means if we can't take something out of a container in 6 or 7 months, it's going to be a pretty poor story, and join it up to the power and join it up to the water. In Silver King, when the and our partners have actually put in a flotation plant, completed the flow plant, completed the screening section, completed the crusher section, built the tailings dam, and arranged for external power, all done. Again, if we earn into that project in the end of this year, the ablution blocks and some small accommodation for the resident miners is going to take us 12 months to build them. We're not very, very good with, you know, at building. So I think in both situations, the intent is to get into production as fast as we can. In antimony, it's driven by the need to get our marketplace secure. I don't want to be a late entry to it, and I want to make sure, as I said earlier, that it's a full circle. That if you just mine antimony and you haven't procured a marketing agreement, i.e. your full circle, I think we would be remiss. The interest is there now, there's a lot of it, and we're talking to people about completing the circle. So we're under a lot of pressure, self-imposed pressure, by the way, Kevin, to in actual fact get that Moroccan situation up and running. Silver King, we're not going to change the world with the few thousand tons of copper, but what we are going to do is, and that's, this is what the government wants to see, is a small operation initiative being implemented, foreign companies working with locals. And secondly, we've got a presence there, so our exploration will be continuing. So there's, as I say, self-imposed pressure to get both operations going sooner than later, which, of course, one of the reasons, again, why we had the place in, because we wasn't short of cash for our normal business, for exploration, what have you, but we were certainly, to start mines up needs more cash than the normal cash requirements we'd forecasted for the business. So self-imposed pressure to get into production in Morocco and in Zambia.
So Cooper Lemon are going to be involved with...
Yes, indeed, in the form of Overmine, that's correct, yes.
What sort of level of silver are you expecting in terms of the small mine that you're talking about?
Well, you've seen over 100 grams in quite a few of the samples, so it'll be very high.
So we could be talking 2, 3, 4 ounces of...
Yeah, I mean, that's Zambia's first mine, 1880. I mean, that's why it's called Silver King. It wasn't a copper mine, it was a silver mine. So yes, we'll have good company in silver.
I'm assuming that the money that's come out from Manika is still on track and everything's happening.
That's correct. We received about 50% of it. We deferred the sulfide lump sum payment. They're getting to the position now, the company we sold to, they're getting to the position where now they want to put the to erect the sulfide plant. That will trigger a significant single payment. And as we stand now, all payments are up to date.
Yeah, Colin, so on Bushranger, where obviously the resource there already, and then I believe that we needed to hit $10,000 copper to make the economics work. But you can correct me, obviously, if I'm wrong. Obviously, we've had a little bit of inflation, so capex costs would be higher. But are you thinking about monetizing that next year as well, or is it on the back burner?
Well, we've got to take the clock back a little bit. It was $11,000, and then we did more ore sorting test work, spent about $80,000. Reworked the financial model, and the break even then is about 10,000 now. So any Australian, you've got to remember this is 50 miles from Sydney. any Australian company who was taking a long-term view of copper have got an exploration project there which has got 1.3 million tonnes of contained copper. It's got 9 million tonnes of higher grade, which is 0.62. It's got the ability to take the masses of 0.24 up to about 0.37. And by ore sorting, you can lower the footprint of the plant, therefore the capital costs. The tailing dams are smaller. General infrastructure is smaller. I'm absolutely convinced, Charles, that that will be one of the next generation of copper mines in the world. And are we going to monetize it? The answer is that will probably be the route. Australia is, for some reason, and the Australian mining market is much more bullish on copper than the UK mining market. And they're already penciling in 12. So if this thing breaks even 10, any company what's got a vision of 12 and 12 being sustainable will be more attracted to what to Bushman than companies might be in the UK. So we're not going to spend much more money on it. We'll basically continue to carry out all of our obligations under the license. We will continue to rework the numbers. We will probably do some more ore sorting, but not a lot. We don't need to. It's all laboratory scale stuff. It could almost stand a listing on itself, but I would like it to go alongside a similar type project. And there are a few in Australia and there are a few in Southeast Asia. So yes, to answer your question, I think Bushranger will have a place in tomorrow's world. Is as recognition comes that new copper is needed and with the appropriate ore sorting and other technical implementation, that in actual fact becomes a viable project. I think that recognition will come, and I think that we will be able to monetize it in the next year, 18 months.
Excellent.
And Australia seems to be the market because, for no better reason, that's where the project is located. And for no better reason than the Australians really understand the Lachlan Fold area, where, you know, is the geological system in which the ore body is situated. And you remember, Charles, that, you know, you've got 1.3 million tonnes here, which is completely open-ended.
Yeah. Lots to be found. Yeah.
Well, you know, 1.3 million tonnes of contained copper. Where on earth is that size of resource around the world?
Yeah, I mean, another way, the other thing is that it's in Australia, you know. there is, regardless of, you know, your views about speed production or, you know, the advantage of Africa, which there are many, I don't think you can argue Australia is a jurisdiction which is, you know, if you were going to pick almost anywhere in the world to have a copper deposit, most people would choose Australia if they could pick where it might be.
That's right. I mean, one of the massive question marks against any mining project in this day and age is jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And as you say, that they certainly tick that box. Mm-hmm. Bushranger ticks that box in a nice way.
I'm sort of listening to you two guys talking about antimony in Morocco, which should be in production in the next 12 months and hopefully sooner. We've got copper and silver in production in Zambia, again, should be in production within the next 12 months. Producing cash flow, how much profit is to be decided. We've then got Bushranger, and you've also got the licenses and assets that are in Zambia. One question that I pose is, how much money was actually spent on Bushranger in terms of it having an intrinsic value? Because somebody's going to have to pay you back everything that you've put into the ground as a norm in mining. So how much would that be in dollars?
I think that's getting too close to what sort of deal we might structure. And it's almost negotiating in, you know, on a podcast with an Australian suitor, of which there are a few. You know, we certainly won't deal with a junior. We'd rather hope that it would go into the arm of a major who's into copper exploration. And I'm not sort of, I wouldn't want to suggest a figure that we would in equivalent value, be it shares or be it cash, match. But you're not talking about a small project. You're talking about 1.3 million tons of copper. So instead of just talking about some capital, just apply one 1.3 million tons at $100 per inferred ton. Gives you some idea what you're talking about in terms of gross value of copper in ground, open pitable, 50 miles from Sydney. So you've really got to apply more numbers and more thinking to what is the ultimate deal. Again, you know, to drill it out completely, to do all the metallurgical test work, to design the mine, there's a lot of money to go there as well, Kevin. And open-ended means open-ended. So 1.3 could be 2.6, could be 5 billion. tons of, you know, 5 billion tons of copper. So this is huge. It's in the Lachlan Belt, and Newcrest was there for years, making money not very far away from us. And so value, what's the value? The, as I say, there's a lot of moving parts in that discussion. Not just getting your money back.
Yeah, no, I understand that. At the same time, I was saying or asking that question as a comparison to your current market cap. Currently, you have £2 million of the money that you've just raised, or, you know, maybe slightly less after expenses. You have the potential to still receive £3 to £4 million from the other project that you had, the gold project in Mozambique, and you're in a situation where your market cap is £7 million.
That looks pretty healthy, doesn't it, when you think about it?
Well, it looks absolutely ridiculous, to be really honest.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. You know that. But then again, you know, does that make Extract unique? Look across our market. Does it make our stable unique? Look across at the complete marketplace and the undervaluation of the entire market. The loss of confidence in the junior mining sector. 5 years of being in the absolute wilderness. Is all in that statement, Kevin, you know. But, you know, if it, the old adage that the market always gets it right, you do have to wonder, don't you? You do have to wonder when you've got nearly as much cash due to you as your market cap, 1.3 million tons of copper, the prospect of profits from two different environments in two commodities and strong exploration projects, it does make you wonder how these valuations are arrived at. But I do think, you know, I mean, talking against myself, we have to accept, I think, the junior sector in general is that, you know, there's not been many discoveries in London since I think I made the last real one, in 2009, the Kalambila project. And show me a big discovery since then, which in actual fact materialised into a sale where shareholders, there was a big dividend, a big payout to shareholders, you know, went up to 265 million in 19 months. And so there's been, you know, that we've had 5 years of difficulty. We've got the competition of tech, like we had the dot-com boom a few years ago. Now it's tech. We've got a lack of confidence in smaller companies generally, not necessarily resource companies. Smaller companies in general have had a dreadful experience alongside resource companies. You've got investor confidence. Six months ago, probably, was at an all-time low. And geopolitical disturbances, uncertainty, like you've never seen in your life. So, in no small way, we're the victim. There's a lot of things that go into the pot to make market capitalizations very low compared to assets. There's also, you know, one's got to look and say the AIM market is ready for some success. It's going to be production success, I hope, in our case, and discovery success. And I'm sure a lot of CEOs out there will attend on your podcast with the same ambitions. I mean, it's no good me sticking my head in my beer and saying, oh, life's not fair. I'm not made that way, Kevin. We're working flat out to get income into our companies. And we know the anger that dilution brings. We know the disappointment that dilution brings. But equally, we know that if you have no revenue, the way you keep your business making progress is to basically use your share currency. And so I'm trying to basically move away from that model and have production and make sure my production is accompanied by great exploration targets. And I think in no small way we're moving well towards that objective.
Any last words, Charles?
Nope, sums it up nicely. I think basically we're moving away from just pure exploration to revenue generation, and we're going to see it next year, and we're going to stay tuned.
And at this level, stay invested, I would suggest.
Well, thanks for that, gentlemen. Been a very useful discussion. As you say, well, let's see then. Tomorrow, next year should be a very exciting year. We've got the festive season coming up, which always slows things down. But everybody needs a bit of a rest. And I look forward to a very active year. And I can only thank my team for that. You know, I've taken some doing to assemble a team of youngies, oldies, very highly qualified academics, very practical people. And I think that in terms of being able to execute our ideas, our plans, our concepts, our developments, to be able to execute them, we've put together still a small team, but a very, very, very strong team. And I have to thank them to in no small way, and in fact, in a very big way, for getting us where we are now. It's for me and it's for them to use everything, all the tools we've got in our box to, in actual fact, make things happen in the companies.
Yeah, I think people forget about it when they buy a ticker that it's dirty work. You know, I haven't visited Silver King, stood on it above the pipe there, and also been to Hoop and Gorup and to the processing plant. You know, it's not easy work that's going on to produce these metals. We can talk about, oh, we'll get this out of the ground, we'll get this out of the ground and it'll be worth X. But there's a lot of work that goes into doing that, and that's obviously what has to happen to have success in these days.
That's right. There's no shortcuts. There's no easy way, Kevin.
Indeed. Anyway, thanks for your time, Colin, and I look forward to speaking to you in the not-too-distant future.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thanks, Kevin. Good day.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best mover of the week is actually Zenith Energy, up some 40%. And they've had a lot of news in the last couple of weeks, Kevin. I don't know if you've seen, but obviously putting a spark in for one moment there, the three major arbitrations with Tunisia, which we've talked about in the past, they actually applied for exploration permits covering Italy's two largest uranium deposits, Val Vedolo and Novazza, marking the first time the Lombardy authorities have formally accepted any applications. And these historic AGIP-discovered deposits contain extensive underground workings and significant past resource estimates, around 6,000 tonnes of uranium and 1,000 at the Novazza. So that's quite interesting. And they've also created a new subsidiary, Futuro Energetico Italiano, to hold the advance of the projects, considering spinning out a separate listed uranium vehicle. And they've also got the other approval projects for the EIA for Ministry of Environment as well, so which is a new phase of exploration, which could become Europe's most strategically important uranium belt. So diversification across those. What do you think of that?
I didn't hear that. I missed it completely. What price are we talking about now for Zenith?
I think they're around about 4p with a 20 million cap from when I last looked at it. But if you look at, if we go back to the arbitration, they've got three major arbitrations with Tunisia. The first is an ICC case 01, which resulted in a $9.7 million award, which was in December 2027. The second is a much larger ICC claim, around $130 million, which was rejected in 2025. And then Zenith are now seeking annulment in the Swiss Federal Supreme Court. But the biggest one is the third, which is an ongoing ICSID arbitration under the UK-Tunisia investment, which could be worth $503 million, and with final hearings expected in 2026. So if they get one of those three awards, I mean, they've had the first one, but if they get one of the second ones, or second or third, then we're talking 10, 20 bagger on the current price?
Well, from 20 million, maybe not on the first one, but certainly possibly on the second one. I mean, if I remember rightly, back only a few months ago, it was around the 15p mark, I think, at one point, maybe even slightly higher. I don't remember the exact numbers. And then they had that sort of kick in the teeth there in terms of the Swiss thing, which really sort of somebody put a pin in the balloon, if you like.
They rejected it, didn't they? And yeah, now they're seeking an annulment in the Swiss Federal Supreme Court to follow that one up. But I'm saying the third and the biggest one, which is potentially worth, Zenith are claiming $503 million. That is a big one.
Yeah, no, that's $350 million market cap, isn't it? I mean, let's take tax and everything else off and the fact that they lose 30% of it to the lawyers and all the rest of it. But you're still talking about probably 150, 200 million pounds, which would be 6, 7, 8, 9 times what the market cap is right now. But this uranium sounds very interesting. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that we've got three sectors that are going to be important over the next few years. Energy is definitely one of them, as it always is. Resources is definitely one of them in general. But I'm focusing on copper and gold. I think those two, and silver, sorry, those two or three are going to be very, very important. And then the other one, I think, is also going to be pharma type stuff that is trying to solve problems for big groups. I think these are the three areas that I like the most, but we'll see.
And then the biggest shaker of the week was Big Blue Broadband. BBB's the ticker, down some 70%. They updated investors on the deferred consideration linked to the 2024 sale of SkyMesh. Under that deal, BBB could receive up to 6.9 million Aus dollars plus additional amounts tied to profit and other adjustments, but deductions relating to customer debt recovery from SkyMesh's Pathfinder system issues may offset or exceed any payment due. So there's ongoing discussions with the buyer, SKM, Skymet, meaning that BBB may ultimately receive nothing or could even face a financial obligation back to SkyMesh. So they also announced plans to seek shareholder approval to delist from AIM, hence the 70% drop in share price on, I think it was Friday's close. So that was one. In terms of over the pond, WeShop Holdings, I don't know if you saw this, WeShop shares on NASDAQ, they listed at the beginning of the week and they moved from around the $20 mark to well over $200 each by the end of trading on the Wednesday session. And then I think it fell back to around about $140 on Friday close. Really interesting. Forbes, I don't know if you saw this, but they published an online article on WeShop in the afternoon, and it was very cautious about the company, which it called financially fragile, and said that the shares were a high risk, high volatility, speculative play with a potentially bumpy ride ahead. And it pointed out that the US market can be attracted by this story rather than the fundamentals. And as I say, that $237 mark of high closed at $36 the previous day. And the Forbes article may have sparked profit taking after close, but there's still an opportunity to potentially take advantage. I mean, I think it's valued around like $1.5 billion. The market cap soared to 4.66, but finished around $2 billion on the Friday. So, what
well,
do you
no,
make of that?
I don't think it was as much as that. It finished at 113 on the Nasdaq, and then after trading has basically been pretty much the same. That would value the market cap in total at 1.24 billion, and that's from Yahoo dollars. So let's say just over a billion pounds, or sorry, just under £1 billion, and
Yeah,
we
but don't
cap.
forget, Kev, you've got A shares and B shares as well. So you've got the combine. The A shares are the main capital structure of the company, and then you've got the B shares, which are the issued to the shoppers using the social media platform. So you have to take into consideration those as being part of the actual total value of the company, if that makes
Ah,
sense.
yes, but what I'm quoting you here is the market cap of just the A shares. Ultimately, it'll be the A shares that I think will value this, but I take your point. But it's currently valued at about, let's say, 900 million pounds, and WeCap have 12% of that, so that's 100 million pounds. WeCap itself is valued at about 11 or 12 million pounds, so that is quite the arbitrage. I'm not looking at it being valued at $200 a share, but basically you're looking at 11, 12 million pound valuation for WeCap, and a current valuation in terms of WeShop in the US at 1.2 billion for the shares. Now, the interesting thing I think is that this valuation may well be fragile because it's been up and down like a banana, basically up down, up down, up down, like a trampoline. So it's finding its feet in terms of its valuation. But there's been all sorts of rumors that one of the big VC companies in the US has been sniffing around, taking a good portion of shares. And one of the places that they could take that from is WeCap. There was a report that $300 million offer was possible for the whole of WeCap's shares, which would be basically give them 15 bagger from here. And that's not going to have to wait for a tie-in, the 6 months soft or 6 month hard, 6 month soft. That would just be a straight buyout, and then they would have to look at whether they stay in or not. But they're not going to be buying that just for fun, if you like. They're going to be holding it because the comparisons are things like Etsy, things like
Temu.
Amazon, even from the point of view that shoppers can do their shopping and get a kickback for
Yeah,
the
get the share,
store
they get shares in the company, yeah. So it's like
shares in the company. Yes, they are B shares, as you said, but ultimately they'll have the option 12 months after purchasing that they will be able to use. If it catches on, this could be phenomenal. It really could. It could be a
of
huge
course.
company. It's a case of will it catch on? Now, what I think is going to happen is that WeShop are going to go in there and raise significant funds probably within a few months. And then the WeCap valuation is going to be solidified by that raise. Either that or at that race, they will be able to exit. So it will be one of the other. But I can't see how it's not going to be worth significantly more. The only way it's not is if WeShop basically goes bang and all of a sudden there's no idea at all. Because even at a valuation of about $20 per share, WeCap is still undervalued.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you're absolutely right. I think that they've got a discounted capital bond of like 6.97 million of WeCap as well. So even taking that off, the valuation appears to be around 22 pence per share based on that. That's just at $122 share price. And this is a piece that Investing Magazine put out, actually, which I pulled this information from. But I think, yeah, WeCap shares rose, didn't they, in the week to on the day that the sort of on the Wednesday to about four and a half. And I think they finished the week around two and a half pence or something. So they did drop back. There was some of that.
No, it dropped back, but there was the final trade on Friday was 3p.
So yeah, that was just an uncrossing trade, wasn't it? That wasn't indicative of the actual, like, the day's trading. That was like, I think it was 2.5, 2.7.
It had gone on Friday from 3 point something down to 2 point, as you say, 5.67, and that was the trade that it was trading in, and then. Yeah, maybe
always get one of those UT trades on crossing that comes in and just completely skews it. But I reckon 2.5 to 2.7p is where we're at the moment. But as you say, it's early days. Nobody knows how to really value it. It's almost a bit of a fad, isn't it, at the moment, because it's hit the market and everyone's got, there's a buzz around it. People enjoy using it. All these, I mean, if it can get to the valuation, even a tenth or a fraction of the valuation of some of the likes of Temu and Shein and other trade, you know, online kind of retail apps like that, where you get a kind of kickback, as you say, from the share element of things, the B shares, it's almost like a mutual. You're buying and you're earning loyalty rewards in the form of shares, which is, I think, is a great idea.
Yeah.
Hot Rock Investments also, just to make a note, because the article references that Hot Rock Investments on Aquis, HRIP is the ticker. They own 150,000 shares in WeShop as well, not WeCap, but the actual US NASDAQ listed entity, WeShop, which made the value, which would put their value up to, I think it was around $7.5 million of valuation just on those shares, around the $122-$130 mark. And their market cap is £2.8 million. So a lot of value in that one, potentially, if you want to get an exposure to. And obviously, don't forget, that's got a portfolio of shares in the likes of Smarter Web Company, Hamac, and, you know, have a look at that one. FTSE at 9539, Kev, obviously a little bit of jitters in the week. Charles wrote an excellent article on that. Did you see that? But basically, he says that the current weakness that we've seen in the market, largely being driven by Japan, where soaring government bond yields, the breakdown of yield curve control, and a huge new stimulus package have triggered a loss of confidence in the sovereign debt market. That shift is forcing Japanese institutions to repatriate capital, pulling money out of the US and European bonds, just as global governments face massive refinancing needs, and it's distorting long-standing correlations in currencies and rates. The resulting liquidity squeeze is fueling widespread deleveraging, hitting everyone from US equities to Bitcoin, which is falling not on fundamentals, but because leverage funds are dumping anything liquid to cover those losses. So what do you make of that? There's a lot of aggressive selling of stocks as well, while as retail continue buying the dip, as it seems, and central banks are responding to bond market stress with even more stimulus.
Yeah, I mean, it's a rabbit hole, isn't it? If you want me to go down the rabbit hole, be here for 3 hours, but I don't really want to go down the rabbit hole. But all I see is that we've got US stocks massively overvalued. We've got UK stocks massively undervalued, in my view, in terms of fundamentals. You mentioned Bitcoin, and that brings me on to the next stock which I want to talk about, which is Amazing AI. It's had one hell of a roller coaster in the last week or two. Basically, I had a chat with Paul Matheson, the CEO, and basically said to him, what the hell's going on? It's flip-flop, flip-flop. You know, we're doing this, we're doing that, we're doing the next thing. And I said to him, you know, you need to steady the ship here. You need to say what's going to happen and then get on with it. You know, there is a great business there. You've got money lending business in the UK. For me, it looks like a perfect storm, right? It's way oversold as a share. It was worth less than the cash in the business on Thursday, you know, trading trading at 0.15 to 0.12. And now, even it had a rally on Friday, but got up to about 0.3, I think, 0.35. Still worth less than cash and Shell. Okay, so now you're basically going in on that. I believe the market makers are still short as well because they thought it was going to crap, basically. But plans are now being put into place. It's going to go on the OTC market. What was the best opportunity available to Amazing AI for their crypto thing? What would be the best thing that could have happened before they put the money in?
What would be the best? Well, obviously, if we're talking about the leveraging things of it, the massive drop in the value of Bitcoin because you're going against it.
So you couldn't have had a better situation in terms of the delay of it not happening, okay? Because he was being pressured and pushed and, you know, invest at 120,000 Bitcoin and all the rest. And he was holding off. He was holding off because he could see what was ahead, I think.
So my question is potentially to you, Kev, is that with that recent drop in the value to, say, 78 or you could call it 80,000 as a sort of lower bench, does that mean that the company would have benefited and actually got some money revenue generated from that or at the moment, or does it have to hang around, you know, just sort of explain how that works?
Okay, how it works is that he would have basically not benefited by the drop. Okay, if you'd invested at 125 and then subsequently it drops to now 82 or whatever it happens to be on said day, the option that he would have been taken out, which would have been, I think it was at 50,000 or 60,000.
Yeah.
That option would become more valuable. Okay. Right. But the other option, which was the bigger play, would become less valuable for it going up in value. Right. Okay. So we definitely are more biased towards it going up, but there is a protection on the way down. Okay.
Yeah.
So now all of those things are going to be in a better situation because now rather than maybe looking at 300,000 Bitcoin valuation for your option, you could be looking at 200,000 and still be in the same price range, if you understand what I mean, because we're starting from a much lower base. I think once it goes on OTC, you're going to get American buyers coming in here as well. It's crazy valuation. It's only worth like £1 million or something like that as we stand, with cash in the bank, access to a £5 million pound loan account, and basically the loan situation, from what Paul is telling me, is in play. And you know, watch this space. He didn't tell me anything, but things are coming, so that it can be a business as well as the crypto. Okay. Now I will say it, and I know Paul will listen to this as well, but he's been manic in terms of putting information out, and things have been changing, things have been doing this. Like, it's been mad.
Yeah, absolutely. There has been a lot of kind of like not sporadic information out there, but the last I saw was that the spin out was cancelled. And I thought that would have sort of steadied the ship. And there was a little bit of an increase in the share price from, I think it went down to 0.2 and it moved up to sort of 0.38, 0.4. But what was the reason behind the spin out cancellation, Kev? Can you explain a little bit about the Mauritius thing?
I think it was because the shareholders were upset. So basically they cancelled it. I don't actually think that was necessarily the wise move, but you know, they're moving in many different ways very quickly. And I said this to Paul, he needs to pick his method, stick with it, and run with it. Okay. The other thing which he has applied for, and it has been confirmed by the broker, that he's applied to buy more stock. Because before they raised money, before they raised sort of the £1 million that they raised recently at a penny, he was 50 something percent shareholder, and now he's down to 38.5p. He's applied to go back to being 50% shareholder again, but he needs approval from the market. And once he gets approval, then he was basically saying his intentions are he's going to buy himself because he believes obviously the market is misvaluing this whole thing. So yeah, so there you go. So happy to say I'm a shareholder, and you know, I think it's got the potential to be massive upside. And where's the downside now? Okay, so where is the downside now? It's cash in a shell. And it's worth more than the cash in the shell, as far as I can see.
Yeah,
you know, so it's almost like a hit to nothing, if you like, as far as I can see. The other news that I saw, which is very small news, obviously, but Incantera having a Black Friday sale for a week there on this, and that brings me round to the subject of you were at the Aquas Awards or Aquas something this week. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I went to the Aquas Showcase, which was held in Holborn at the Royal College of Surgeons, which is a really, really nice venue. I don't know if you've ever been, but it's an amazing building. And yeah, what it does is it brings together a selection of Aquas listed companies, and they are grouped together into three groups: Group One, Group Two, Group Three, and then that's usually four companies per group. And then they give a pitch for about 8 minutes. Each company gets 8 minutes, put together a pitch. And then at the end of that group session, the audience can then vote for the company in that group, which they think, you know, that they would invest in, or whichever pitch they preferred. And then at the end of the day, there is awards, basically winner announced based on the number of votes of the total of the groups. And yeah, and this year's winner was B Hodl, actually. It was the Bitcoin Treasury and Lightning Network payment system. You know, Freddie New, we've talked about him in the past. So congratulations to Freddie and the B Hodl team there. There was a few others that I want to just mention who I saw them. Obviously, Incantera were there. So I spoke to Tim and Suzanne, and they had a lot of their products on the stand. Their five products, don't forget, you know, the face, the eye, the serums, the hand cream, etc. And they were giving away little sample packs of that to people who were interested in testing the product out. So that was really good to see. And as you say, there's going to be a Black Friday sale through the website, which will be really, really good to see. And then there was also Ajax Resources was there, gentleman CEO called Ippolito Cattaneo. They've got a couple of projects, copper projects, and I think lead, zinc, silver in Chile as well. So that looks pretty good as well. Probably looking to talk to Ippolito in the coming weeks and get him on the podcast. And then there was Newbie Racecourse.
They bought the asset off Galileo.
He did, yeah, absolutely. Because we talked about Colin, and he said, yeah, he knew him. Equipmake Holdings were there, who provide a lot of the inverters to the electric car manufacturers, you know, the likes of some of the fire trucks in America. I think they provide Rimac as well with their inverters as well. Oberon Investments were there as well, Sulnox, and obviously Andrew Webley from the Smarter Web Company was there presenting as well. Obviously a bit of a drop back in the share price from recent times, but yeah, really, really good day. Very, very interesting presentations. And as I say, that I think that on Aquas, looking at some of these companies in this brochure, there are some amazing companies, Kev, that are flying under the radar. And I think we need to get more of them on the podcast to get the story out. I genuinely think there's some really good companies out there.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think the innovative companies seem to be going on to Aquas, is my view.
Right.
You know, yeah. It's like the almost like the new economy is starting to think about that. So that's good. So it was
a really interesting one, Kev. Just a quick mention to Robin Stein, the CFO of a company called Inco Investments, and you'll like this one because they're based in Cape Town, and the social impact investment firm focused on poverty reduction and environmental sustainability in the sub-Saharan Africa, founded in 2001. It invests in these SMEs across ecotourism, healthcare, finance, and clean energy. And they have a kind of portfolio of these, you know, these like eco lodges down there, and you can go on safari. So they get revenue from that. But they also have like different kind of ethical farms where they take like they produce biomass pellets from waste, if that makes sense, you know, in like a natural environment. So it's that one's got like a market cap of 8 million. The ticker is INQO. So watch out for that one. I'll try and get Robin on because it's a very fascinating woman, really interesting company. And they've got an impressive financial turnaround from the prior year's loss, enabling its first dividend on that one. So, yeah, not many small cap acres companies paying dividends, I wouldn't have thought.
No, so, yeah. Indeed not. Very good. The other news that struck me this week as I was reading through it, though it didn't really have much of an impact because it's been such a sort of wobble on in terms of the market, was the news for GMET on their Pilot Mountain copper porphyry, basically. Yep. It looks like it's a huge, big shell. And effectively, they're saying that normally when you have a big shell like this, that the copper is basically on the edge of the shell. How I sort of envisaged it in my mind is almost like a big buried ball or a big buried egg. And all around the edges of this porphyry are what they believe is then going to be a huge copper resource. So I'm looking forward to that in terms of seeing what's ahead, because that would add yet another asset into the Pilot Mountain with the tungsten, the silver, the garnet, and now we're talking about the copper as well, potentially. And also the news that the reality is there's probably going to be a spin out of Garfield and Golconda as well for shareholders. So yeah, still maybe plenty of room to run in GMET over the next period of time. So yeah, let's see. We'll have to get Oliver on again in the next few weeks and see what he's got to say.
And they're also putting together a comprehensive operational update, which is going to be released in due course. And I think they're also hosting third-party site visits as well, specifically on that porphyry potential at the Porphyry South. Yeah, I saw that early in the week, as you say, that kind of like that inversion, the IP survey, and then the final inversion results from the survey have been received. And there were some very well-defined areas and, as I say, strong chargeable anomaly formed with a well-defined halo, which does look interesting. So I think it's, they're saying that the aligns with the highest copper results obtained from the surface rock chip sampling completed to date as well on that last RNS.
Yeah, and basically I think how they identified this shell is that on surface, the rock samples were at their highest level on this sort of edge, if you like, inside the edge of the egg or ball or whatever way you want to explain it.
I think shell was good enough.
Yeah, I think, you know, try to explain those things. So I think that's good. I think we've got Sovereign Metals seems to be well overdone in terms of, you know, people's fear of the what's happening in the government there and et cetera, but I spoke to Sapan. Hopefully we'll get him on in the not too distant future. Also spoke to Tim during the week as well about Encantera. He wanted to hold off for a couple of weeks before he comes and talks to us.
Bitcoin Collective, mate. I've spent Friday with loads of Bitcoin maxes. It was really interesting up in Derby. Yeah, I went along to Jez Casey from the Bitcoin Collective invited me up to see some of the talkers up there, and there was, you know, like Joe Nakamoto was there, you know, talking about Bitcoin. Why now is the best time to buy, and you know, it's had a drop back, it's cyclical, we don't look at the price, all that usual stuff that goes on at these Bitcoin conferences. But Liz Truss made an appearance. It was actually fascinating to hear a talk. Yeah, blame the mini budget on the Bank of England and the OBR for the untimely release of the pension, of the bonds, and apparently that caused the pension funds to panic and, you know, sell off, and that's what caused the crash, apparently. So two sides to every story, Kev. Okay.
Couldn't be her fault, but I think she's probably better than Rachel from accounts, no?
Probably, yeah.
And what was the name of the guy who was the that also fell on his sword? He was the
Quasi.
And he was a good guy, I think, you know. I don't think he was a bad he was a very intelligent guy, and but they had to fall on their sword for doing what probably would have been the right thing for the country. That's my view. But the markets didn't
The market that initially reacted really, really well, because it was all like helping people, the higher earners were getting a bit of a relief. It was actually looking like a really good budget for the higher earners in terms of, you know, reduction in the amount of income tax they pay and all those sort of things. But as you say, it just spooked the other market. Maybe it was a mistiming anyway at the end of the day. But
One more just before you go, because you just made me think about it. When you were with all these Bitcoin maxis, we had Astrid change this week. It looks like their subnet is rocking and rolling now as well. And they changed everything, all the Ethereum, all the Solana that they had, and they've changed it to a completely Tau play. So I was like, wow, this is great. This is going to be the one company now on the UK stock market that if you're interested in Tau, which basically is Bitcoin for developers, if you like, they've gone all in on Tau. Now, they still have plenty of cash. But one of the names was very interesting, Mr. Kidd, who's been on our podcast before a few years ago, if you remember.
Yeah,
he's Bitcoin Maxi. So I'm interested to watch how that one goes, because I think it could now be, I mean, it's valued less than the asset value of it. Probably by the arbitrage is probably 80 to 100% of its market cap. So I don't understand why it's still sitting where it is, to be honest. But now they've taken over. Even in this time, you know, the scenario is that Tau is going to be halving in the next few months, one of the halving situations. And normally what happens with these cryptos is that after the halving thing, you normally go on a run. So it's not in the same schedule, if you like, that Bitcoin's on. You know, Bitcoin is not at that stage at the minute, whereas Tau is. So you could see after the halving that Tau could do very well. And obviously Astrid is going to be producing the Tau from the subnet. And there seems to be a lot more staking going on, which allows them then to get more business and create more Tau on a daily basis. So yeah, I'm pretty excited about that one actually, because it was sort of sitting there doing nothing. Now,
I saw that appointment of Siam as the CSO, Chief Strategy Officer, and he does bring a wealth of experience. So certainly, I know he's a big proponent of Bitensor or Tau. So be interesting to see what they do with that one. Sports, mate. I don't know if you've been following Australia and England. Obviously, Ashes battling out in Perth. England got bowled out for 172 on day one, thanks to Mitchell Stark's 7-wicket haul. And last I saw, Australia were at like 123 for 9, trailing by 49 runs. But I don't know what the latest is on that one, Kev. Maybe bring that one up. But what do you make of that? Not the best start for England, is it?
Not the best start, but if Australia are now behind, then maybe it wasn't so bad after all. let me just give you the absolute up-to-date as we speak. Australia win by 8 wickets. So it's finished.
Finished, there you go.
So Australia were all out for 132. England were all out for 172. Then England went again, 164. Oh, well done, boys. They only lasted 32 and 34 overs, right? And then Australia knocked off 205 and 28 overs. It's an embarrassment.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what wasn't an embarrassment, Kev. Scotland national football.
Wow, did you see those goals?
Yeah, I mean, the goals. Scott McTominay for the first one. But the best one without a doubt was Kenny McLean's strike from the halfway
line. Yeah, mate, unbelievable.
I mean, did you see the crowd when they were all celebrating? They apparently had a seismometer in the area that obviously is monitoring for earthquake activity. It recorded shockwaves enough to trigger the seismometer because the crowd were going ballistic. The Scottish fans, fair
play. They were all bouncing up and down, weren't they?
Yeah.
And then Robertson then came out with very tearful scenario about Jota at the end of it as well, because he was like thinking about his mate and that one of the both of their dreams was that they would go to the World Cup in 2026.
So that
was touching. But to be honest with you, McTominay has become a world beater after leaving Manchester United. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, he could be up for the Ballon d'Or at this rate of going in terms of the
third-minute goal, overhead/bicycle kick. I mean, what a goal.
Absolutely unbelievable goal. And his confidence is going through the roof. And, yeah, so it was great to see. Great to see.
Scotland qualifying automatically there, obviously, for the 2026 FIFA World Cup. And that's their first appearance at the final since 1998. So it just shows you how long it's been for the Scots to...
Did you see the last-minute goal for Ireland as well, though?
No.
The last-minute goal for Ireland against Hungary, it meant that Szoboszlai, for Liverpool player, didn't he's captain of Hungary. They didn't qualify because of it, I think. But they were 2-1 down against Hungary. I think it was in Hungary, or maybe don't quote me on that. Maybe it wasn't. But they were 2-1 down, 10 minutes to go. They scored to make it 2-2, and in injury time, they basically scored like it was a Hail Mary from the keeper straight into the box. Somebody nods it on and boom, in the back of the net. The 3-2, the Irish were going bananas. We saw all the reactions in all the pubs around Ireland. It was mental. So, yeah.
So Wales are not in yet, but they could have a route through to the I think they've got to play Bosnia and Herzegovina in March in the semi-finals of those World Cup playoffs.
Yeah, Northern Ireland are the same. There's potentially all the home nations could be there. Yeah. Northern Ireland have got to play Italy, so they would knock Italy out if they get it.
Wouldn't be the first time Italy didn't. They didn't go to the last World Cup, so you know what?
Yeah, no. So,
okay.
But we know we've got England in there. We know we've got Scotland.
Yeah, it'd be amazing to have them all. So Formula One as well. Obviously, we've got the 2025, the Las Vegas Grand Prix looming large. Three races left in the season, including the Las Vegas. Still, title still undecided, but Lando Norris is leading his teammate Oscar Piastri by 24 points, and reigning champion Max Verstappen sits 49 behind. Cold conditions in Vegas, believe it or not, which obviously affected the practice sessions. A lot of disruption there, track grip issues, and mysterious manhole cover check. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but the amount of downforce that these cars produce on a street circuit, Kev, mean that when they go over these manhole covers, they actually pull them up from the ground and launch them. So they have to weld them shut now on the circuits. Mercedes F1 team has been valued at around $6 billion after, I don't know if you saw this, but the Toto Wolff boss sold a 5% stake, highlighting the booming commercial side of the sport, which was very, very interesting. And so this weekend, Las Vegas Grand Prix. Next weekend, Qatar.
In the I think it's Norris's to. I wouldn't say Norris's to lose, but I think if he scores some points in the next three Grand Prix, I can't really see him losing.
Yeah, and then the final one of the season, Abu Dhabi Grand Prix.
There's one sprint race in one of those three Grand Prix. Have you any idea which one it is?
It's not Vegas, I don't think. It's either Qatar or I'd imagine Abu Dhabi because it's a much bigger circuit, the Yas Marina circuit.
It's the last, probably because it's the last Grand Prix as well as where they would put the sprint race. So there's a sprint race, so that potentially would leave it still open because there would be 34 points on offer, wouldn't it? It's 9 and 25, I think. Yeah, and the Premier League starts again this weekend as well, so by now we'll know whether any results I don't really want to talk about have come about again, but let's see what happens after the whether Arsenal continue their march or and Manchester City after we got stuffed before the break by Manchester City. So we will see.
Yeah, the sprint race, just for clarity, I just checked, is Qatar, the 28th to 30th. So that's where the next point, as you say, more points on offer from the sprint race in Qatar on the 28th to the 30th. But yeah,
we're also moving into Champions League time again as well. Another couple of fixtures, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to Chelsea. I've got a ticket for Chelsea on. I'm going to watch Chelsea versus Barcelona on the 25th, so this coming Tuesday night, which I'm really looking forward to. So I've never been to the Bridge before, so it's going to be an eye opener.
Yeah, I think it's much updated from the last time I was there, and I told that story the last time, so I'm not going to say it again. But hopefully there won't be any golf balls aimed at your head. But let's see. Yeah.
And just don't forget, Kev, if you do check your attic every now and then, I don't know if you heard this story, but Superman number one comic from 1939, which was found by three brothers while clearing the late mother's attic in California, has just become the most valuable comic book ever sold. Do you want to have a guess how much it sold for at auction?
9.82 million. Ooh, I read the story.
Mate, 9.12 million at auction.
Sorry, I must have misread it. But $9 million. Well, after fees, they probably come away with $8 million for a bloody comic. Absolutely outrageous.
Incredible. So I guess, on that note, if you like what you heard, please subscribe. Hit the bell icon for further notifications of future episodes and have a great weekend all.
Indeed. Enjoy.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.